Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call Monday? We call Monday Rethink the Week. When do we tape Monday? We tape it on Friday morning. So I'm back to a continuation of Ann Nelson's fabulous article, Project 2025, The Latest Plot Against America. We're up to installment number 8. Since it's a 900-page tome, I know you won't read it. But I want to make sure that you understand what the hell is in this Project 2025. And what they call it is the 2025 Presidential Transition Project. Oh, how appropriate. And so we've been literally going through it as she did in her fabulous piece at the Washington Spectator. And I've been literally pulling chunks out of the Spectator in order to share it with you, because I want to repeat it, I want you to be informed about it, and I want you to be concerned about it. And she goes this way. This comprehensive 900-page playbook was produced under the auspices of the Heritage Foundation and supported by over 100 partner organizations. It's officially titled Mandate for Leadership, the Conservative Promise. Project 2025 lays out specifics for hundreds of policy objectives affecting every area of public life, from women, LGBTQ populations, to environmental regulations, to the concentration of power in the executive branch to promote an authoritarian regime. Here is the fifth of 10 things you need to know about Project 2025. And this is from the section entitled Public Health, and I'm actually sort of dividing public health into two sections. But this one is the recommendations concerning health are dispersed among the introduction and various chapters. Together, they argue for an abandonment of government's role in promoting public health for American children and adults. The chapter even seeks to prohibit the CDC from advising the vaccination of school children. As of March 3rd, now we realize we're in sometime in April, outbreaks of measles, a potentially deadly disease easily avoided through vaccination, has been reported in 17 states. That number has increased. Quote, by statute or regulation, CDC guidelines must be prohibited from taking on prescriptive character. This is a quote from 2025. For example, never again should CDC officials be allowed to say in their official capacity that school children should be masked or vaccinated through a schedule or otherwise, or prohibited from learning in a school building. Close quote. That's from 2025. And then she translates, the Centers for Disease Control should be prohibited from attempting to control disease. Thanks to anti-vaccine campaigns, we now confront rampant outbreaks of measles with a statistical likelihood of 1 to 2 preventable deaths per 1,000 children. Is polio far behind? That's her translation. I'm just going to recommend go to the Washington Spectator. It is a long article. It is a fabulous article. I call it my Cliff Notes for Project 2025, but you must read it. All right. This is our Rethink the Week. Let me introduce our fabulous panel of guests. We have Stephen Pimpare, a professor of public policy at Vermont Law School and Graduate School. He is the author of 4 books, including his most recent book, Politics for Social Workers, A Practical Guide to Effecting Change. Welcome back, Mr. Pimpare.
Thank you, Arnie. Good to be here.
Robert Hockett, he joined the Cornell Law Faculty in 2004. His principal teaching, research, and writing interests lie in the fields of organizational, financial, and monetary law and economics in both their positive and normative, as well as their national and transnational dimensions. My favorite line in his bio, his guiding concern in these fields is with the legal and institutional prerequisites to adjust, prosperous, and sustainable economic order. You can read him in Forbes. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Hockett.
Thanks, Arnie. Great to be with you again.
It's a pleasure. Ryan Melton currently manages a team of insurance professionals at a Fortune 100 company. He lives in central Iowa, actually Nevada. I know this. He was the Democratic candidate for the U.S. House of Representatives in Iowa's 4th Congressional District in 2022. And I believe you are running again for that same district. Am I correct, Mr. Melton?
Yes, I am.
Now, have you already had your primary?
Primary is June 4th, but I'm running unopposed for the second straight time.
Oh, well, there you go. That, just a thought, Lincoln. You know, at least he's running. At least he's going to be a warm body in that seat. We've been talking about how the Democrats don't always field candidates and how disappointed we are. Thank you for doing this, Ryan Melton. Lincoln Mitchell teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. He is the author of 8 books, and his writings have appeared at CNN, Reuters, The New York Times, NBC, The San Francisco Examiner. And if you want to read more of him, you go to his Substack, Kibitzing with Lincoln. Thank you so much for doing this, Lincoln.
Thank you for having me. And I apologize for the ferocious dogs in the background.
Okay, that's totally fine. So this morning, and I want to start with you, Mr. Pimpare. This morning, I sent out a map that was posted on my Facebook page. And normally I try to not take something completely random out, but this one blew me away. I'm kind of familiar with the map, but seeing it again and being reminded of it. So I want everyone to envision a map of the United States. And then you look at the map and you see like a concentration of red. And then you see a sea of blue. The blue is in New England. The blue is in sort of the northern Midwest. The blue is along California and again, the West Coast. And maybe little slight sections of Texas and a southern part of Florida. But for the most part, if you're talking about the South, the deep South, we're talking Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, those kinds of places, you see red. And here's what it says. Life expectancy in America, where you see red versus where you see blue. And what you realize is that in the red areas of the map, Mr. Pimpare, there is a 20-year gap in life expectancy. So in the red states, it's 66.8 years. In the blue areas of the country, it is 86.8 years, 20-year gap. This is 2024 in the richest nation in the world. In the world. If I hear that one more time, I'm going to give someone a knuckle sandwich because I'm looking at this map and I'm going, that is a disgrace. So I wanted to start with you because one, you're very familiar with this map. We wish this was a visual show, but you can imagine it in your head. All right, everyone. So let's talk about this map and how you even said there are other maps that if you did overlays, you'd be shocked to see that the same result, except it's telling a slightly different story.
So if you take a look at a map of U.S. poverty rates, for example, you see very much the same pattern, right? You see big spots of if red is sort of deepest level of poverty, you see it spread throughout the Black Belt in periods across the southern border. And importantly, if you look up toward the north, you see it in spots where we have Native American reservations, right? And you can look at a whole host of outcomes. You can look at not just life expectancy and poverty. You can look at access to healthcare. You can look at things like suicide rates, right? And the list goes on and on and on. You see this consistent pattern. Some of this is for what will be listeners fairly obvious reasons, right? It is those are disproportionately Republican states. Those are the states that are more likely not to have, say, expanded Medicaid as part of the Affordable Care Act. So your access to basic health care is limited. There is also a map, and you can Google this if you go online, right? That Abraham Lincoln used when he was plotting military strategy during the Civil War. And that map shows density of slave populations. Pull up that map and pull up the map that Arnie is referencing, or pull up the map of contemporary poverty rates. It's the same map. Still. So it's not merely that we have the contemporary legacy of Republican parties that do active harm to their populations, both Black and white, we should note, but this is also the product of well over a century of formal and informal policies that limit access to policies that improve well-being to one population group or another, to one particular geographic region over another. And this is what people say, right? You shouldn't be teaching CRT, right? Critical race theory is in some ways nothing more than understanding the ways in which racism is not primarily individuals wearing white hoods, but is the ways in which racial bias winds up being instantiated throughout all our institutions in ways that often you cannot see, but have horrible impacts that show disparate impact by race. And the more that people know these things, the more they are inspired to try to fight back against the political system and the policies that create at least two, if not more, classes of citizens. So I think it's really, really, really important that we understand that we are still in some ways living with the legacy of the failure to implement the outcome of the Civil War.
So Robert Hockett, I posted on Facebook the other day that the Tennessee governor, Bill Lee, and five other Southern GOP governors spoke out against UAW's drive to organize the VW plant. Of course, I want to remind everyone that the vote to organize was 73% to unionize. And of course, I'm bringing in this story because, as someone said, well, of course, this is where the lowest paid people are. And I'm like, well, you know, this is a place where they have a long history of what? Of slavery. What do they have? They have a long history of unpaid labor. I mean, think about this. And of course, you've got these five Southern GOP governors speaking out against what? The democratization of the workplace, Robert Hockett. And they are so offended. But I think what's so exciting is that those maps that we're now being described to by Stephen Pimper, one of the ways to fight the maps is, yeah, you might want to wait for the federal government to pass something that may happen at some point in time. You know that until you change the administration in your state, that there might be a change in what happens in your workplace. Or you can do what a lot of folks are now suddenly realizing is you can organize and you can unionize, and suddenly you can then create a contract that makes it possible for you to feed your family, for you to live in a home, for you to send your kids to college. Because if you wait for someone else, it may not happen. But if you organize where you work, it could happen, Robert. And yet I thought it was so interesting that all these governors were talking about the fact that this was going to harm the economy of these states. And I'm thinking, yeah, right, Mr. Hockett.
Well, it's funny how these elites tend to assimilate, you know, the economy to, you know, the 1 or 2% who own most of the productive assets, right? I mean, so yeah, the economy is doing well when the stock market is doing well, if the economy is the people who own everything. But the crucial point is that's not you or I. That's virtually none of us, right? I mean, when those who were occupying Wall Street chanted that we are the 99%, they weren't just, you know, kind of bloviating. I mean, that particular number is based on actual data, right? And it is just the case, right, that the top 1% own the overwhelmingly greater part of the productive assets of the country. The top 1% of that 1% have an even larger concentration of that. And so, yeah, if anybody says the economy's doing great when the stock market is up, or if they said that the economy will be harmed when labor does better, they're pretty much telling you who they are. They're telling you that they're part of that 1%, and that means they're not your friend if you are, you know, one of the 99 out of 100 Americans who isn't an owner of that stuff. That seems to be important, and it seems like it ought to be stressed more often, because even, you know, even media sources that aren't particularly, you know, known to be right wing, like NPR, for example, will oftentimes breathlessly give you the good news about how the stock market's doing. And that's not good news for most of us, at least not necessarily. Right. Final point maybe worth making again is that, as we've noted before, right, it's one of the few, I shouldn't say few, but one of a relatively small number of things to be very happy about right now and optimistic about is precisely this resurgence of labor, right? We're seeing more and more and more. And if we can actually find, you know, more and more companies down in the South get unionized who had previously not been unionized, and if we can see unionization spreading to new industries that didn't used to enjoy it, like, for example, the barista industry or the burger flipping industry, then I think we will have made tremendous progress relative to where we've been since at least the mid-1960s.
So, Ryan Melton, since you are currently going to be running for Congress, I don't know if you were aware of the guy that's running for the U.S. Senate in Nebraska. And it turns out that there's no Democratic candidate running for the U.S. Senate against the incumbent Republican. But the gentleman that is running for U.S. Senate is running as an independent. And who is he? He was the union leader who organized the 2021 Kellogg strike. And as I was reading what he is saying as his first time candidate as an independent for the U.S. Senate, I can't imagine a person in Nebraska not voting for him. Okay. Because I mean, I don't care how Republican the state is that when I think about what he is running on, he is running on virtually everything that I think you just heard from Robert Hockett, people believe in. He was running on economic policies to curb concentrated corporate power, to rebuild the middle class. He's focusing on the monopolies and railroads and big ag and all those things that have a stranglehold over Nebraska's economy. And as I'm reading this template of what he's running on, immediately, Ryan, I'm thinking you guys should talk because I think you should all share material, because a lot of what he is saying is what you are saying. And I think in the end, I don't care whether you're a Republican or Democrat, conservative or liberal, you are speaking to people's lives, you know. And in the end, if you can actually address those things, and from a labor perspective, you can see the result, because they can say, look at this contract, look what we've done. But I think if you can connect that to saying, but we need to make sure that it's not just a labor contract, but that it's a contract with the American people. Ryan.
Osborne is his name, which I find to be really funny. I actually was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. And Coach Tom Osborne of the Nebraska Cornhuskers is a saint in Nebraska, a deified figure. I agree with you. Actually, on the campaign trail last weekend, I sat in on a forum put on by the Iowa Farmers Union. Most people assume that the one and only ag lobby in the Midwest is the Farm Bureau, which is a rather conservative corporatist organization. But there's also the Iowa Farmers Union, which leans more to the left and takes on consolidation in agriculture. So in Nevada, last Saturday, we actually had the FTC chair here, Chair Khan, and it brought a massive cross-section of Republicans, Independents, Democrats, Libertarians into this hall in Nevada. And it was a two-hour public comment section forum on consolidation in ag, particularly a situation here in Iowa where we funded the incentivization of a planting of a fertilizer plant to compete against Coke to help break up or minimize monopoly power on the input side for big ag. And what happened was we put in hundreds of millions of dollars of state and federal tax incentives to create competition against Coke fertilizer. 10 years later, Coke is going to buy that competitor.
So
it's just this microcosm of how it feels like no matter what the small guy can do here in Iowa, even if the government tries to help him, the corporate monopolies are going to win all day, every day. And so what Osborne is doing in Nebraska is what I'm doing here in Iowa, which is trying to, in a nonpartisan way, just talk about the things that are impacting people on the ground. And a lot of it does go back to the disproportionate impact of corporate power on our politics and our governance.
How do we explain to the American worker that, to a large extent, there may be some disappointment in Joe Biden, and there will always be disappointment. And in part, you know, he's handicapped by what he has in the, you know, the slim margin in the Senate and nothing in the House, that what he would like to accomplish, he can't. And I think he has learned what Governor Whitmer, for example, has learned. And that is that once you have the power, you need to sprint and you need to deliver for your voter, for your constituency. I look at this rise of union activity. I look at the support for unions, whether it's from young people. There's a group of young Dartmouth students that just went down to the New Hampshire legislature to testify against a bill that's being replicated all across the United States to prevent, you know, young folks who are working in college campuses from being able to organize and be able to form unions. And these guys traveled down from Dartmouth to say, this bill is about us. Do you want to hear from us? Do you want to hear why we're organizing? And I mean, the legislators were shocked because they didn't care, but all of a sudden they had to care because these people were so articulate about what their issues were. And I really do think that we have to connect the dots, that if you really care about working folks, it's not just that you want to help to organize a union. You need to have the right flavor in Washington to support it, whether it's through the NLRB, whether it's through regulation, whether it's through, you know, somebody actually showing up on a picket line like Joe Biden did, because that not only helps at the national level, it also helps for what you're trying to do either with your employer or what you're trying to do with your state, Lincoln.
I'm not entirely sure of the question, but I'm going to try to answer it anyway. I just want to pick up on something that Bob said first. I generally agree, but I think there's another tension that we really have to talk about here, which is not the 99% and the 1%. It's the 80% and the 20%. Mm-hmm. And 20% of the American population, and I'm borrowing heavily here from Richard Reeves' book, Dream Hoarders, but 20% of the population is 60 million and change. That's a huge number of people. Mm-hmm. And those are the people that are professionals that maybe have a little bit of generational wealth, but are not, you know, don't have a $30 million, right? Aren't making $400,000 a year. That 20% are the people for whom if I don't drive much because I live in Manhattan, but if your transmission breaks on your car, I don't know if cars still have transmission. It's been a long time since I had, but you know, if your transmission breaks, You think, oh, that's a bummer, and you wave your credit card at it, and it gets fixed. For the other 80%, if your transmission breaks, it's a crisis. Almost all of the opinion leaders, almost all of the Congress members, almost all of the senior people in the bureaucracy are in that 20%. Those 20% are likely directly or indirectly to have money in the stock market, et cetera, et cetera. And that is where the real tension is. And it's the 80% that don't have those things that these economic indicators that Bob is talking about are not particularly relevant. And that includes employment numbers. A job where that allows you to live decently, to get out of debt, to put some money away, to have health care is a great thing. A job with a two-hour commute where when you're done paying for childcare and everything else, you're bringing home $4 an hour or something is a mug's game. And for too much of the 80%, that's what a job is. I just want to clarify that. To get to your question, or not clarify, but flesh that out.
Right. I'm just trying to connect the dots to what Biden is trying to do and what workers are attempting.
So to try to answer that, the Republicans are telling a story that Biden can't do anything. And then they're making sure that story is true by stopping him from doing anything. It is not because of the Democrats. It is because of the Republicans. It is assumed that on any kind of progressive economic legislation, you will get, let me just do the math quickly in my head, carry them up, zero Republican votes in either House of Congress. That means they are stopping everything. So that when say the Democrats can't do anything, it's because they're against everything. That message has to get out there, but it's not enough. The other thing is we have a few months till this election. Lay out an ambitious, progressive economic program.
Absolutely.
Do not be afraid to do that. Do not be afraid to say you will significantly raise the minimum wage, just for example. Do not be afraid to go much bigger on things like wiping out a college debt. Do not be afraid to go much bigger on things like making all community college free. All of those things. Have an ambitious, progressive economic agenda and do not run for it. Run from it. Run on it, not from it. I want to just raise one issue about this unions and the story you gave for Dartmouth, because I'm totally with those students. Like, they have my support 100%. And I know Stephen has talked about this a lot, and I'm going to piggyback this just for one moment. This, and we are seeing this, universities are deeply conservative institutions.
Yes.
And they will fight that unionizing effort, whether it's graduate students, whether it's the people who clean the buildings, the people who serve the food in the cafeterias, or untenured professors. But we have more than a century of data that tells us if you want the lives of working people to be better, to have more dignity, to have more economic security, that way, that path goes with labor unions.
Well, and I was just listening. I hate to say I was listening to Morning Joe, but they were talking about the youth survey that comes out of Harvard. And of course, what is the panic of young people? And they said that, you know, what's going on in Gaza is on the list, but it's not in the top five. But what is in the top five are things like their health care, whether they can afford a place to live. It's like all the basics that they feel they're more vulnerable today than their parents ever were. They don't see a path forward. They don't see a house they can afford. I mean, what did they say the other day? The average house in New Hampshire now is on the market for what? $500,000. In 1980, everyone, I bought my house for $42,000. I just want to let you know. That's the 42, and we're not talking 500,000. And then on top of that, I'm just going to make one more point, and then we're going to go to a break. And that is, there was a map done, a story about childcare in the United States. And it was actually done at the Hill, you guys. And guess which state had the highest childcare costs in America? Well, it turned out it was Massachusetts. Not surprising. Massachusetts is a very wealthy community. But guess what the cost of daycare was? The cost of daycare was, on average, $20,000 a year. $20,000 a year. So where do you put the food in, pay for the car payment, find a place to live? And if you are a young person, then guess what? The cost of childcare is the auntie dowry. because that means you're not imagining getting married and you're clearly not imagining having children. And on that note, this is the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. What do we call it? We call it Rethink the Week. When do we tape it? We tape it on Friday morning. We'll be rejoined by Stephen Pimpera, professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School, Robert Hockett at Cornell Law Faculty, Ryan Melton, who is running in the Iowa's 4th Congressional District, and Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. Stick around, folks. We will be right back.
Can it be a crime to sleep in a city park at night when you have nowhere else to go? I'm Bill Newman, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute. And that question was recently argued at the Supreme Court in a case that arose in Grants Pass, Oregon, which has some 600 unhoused people, no public homeless shelter, and an ordinance that first fines and after that issues trespass orders with criminal penalties for sleeping in the park. At the high court, lawyers for those persons facing criminal sanctions argued that they would be punished unconstitutionally for their status of being unhoused. They rely on a 1962 Supreme Court case that held that while a state could punish a person for possession, use, or distribution of a drug, punishing a person solely for their status of being drug dependent is cruel and unusual punishment. Likewise, the status of not having housing, they say, cannot be a crime. Also, it's hard to wrap your mind around how criminalizing not having a place to sleep makes any sense. Of course, the point is not necessarily to make them go to jail. The point is to make them go somewhere else. But, as Justice Sonia Sotomayor asked at oral argument, if every city, every village, every town passes a law identical to this, where are they supposed to sleep? A decision is expected by late June. The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU, because freedom can't protect itself.
This is Lincoln Mitchell with today's Mitchell Minute. Shortly after the war in Ukraine began in February of 2022, I gave a talk, and at the end of my talk, I made the point that this has changed everything. We speak a lot of events that change everything, but that war, the beginning, the full-scale invasion, I believe, really did change everything. But then October 7th happened. And what strikes me is that the Hamas attack on Israel, which led to the response that we have seen from Israel, which, by the way, is the response that Hamas wanted, has had an even bigger global impact. Because that conflict has led to what we see on college campuses today, and not just on college campuses. It has led to protest, outrage at Biden, outrage at Israel, that may be enough to put Trump back in the White House. And if that happens, the impact that will have on democracy globally, on the future survival of the United States of America, will be profound, because that is the real threat that Trump represents. And the wheels were set in motion on October 7th. My sense is that Biden could have been reelected, could be reelected still, with one war, the one in Ukraine. But with two, that task becomes much, much more difficult, particularly because the second one has led to the kind of divisions within the Democratic Party that have always been exploited by Republicans.
The Mitchell Minute is a daily minute or so of political analysis from me, Professor Lincoln Mitchell. If you want to hear more of my opinion and analysis, you can subscribe to my YouTube channel at Mitchell.
It's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When your eyes are open, when you know the history, when your parents lived through things that looked so much like this, all the indications impossible to miss. When you've sought for your whole life to make the earth a better place, and you once again see the rising of the master race. When you know that they are coming, when they announced it in advance, when you know for many people this will be their last chance, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933, when indefinite detention is the new reality for so many children to whom you did not give birth, when you see they're just as precious as every other child on earth, when they're opening the camps not used since the war, where families were imprisoned decades before, when Kristallnacht is coming, they announced it on the news, when the writing's on the wall, when you can see the fuse, then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you.
it's 2019, but it feels like 1933. When you know rallies are not helping and silence is complicity. When you know where the kids are kept, locked inside their cells. When you see approaching the future this foretells. When they're coming for your neighbors. When they've even said what day they plan to put them all in buses and take them away. When you know where they keep the buses. You've been to the parking lot. Perhaps a whole lot of petrol bombs is the best move that you got. Then you may ask the question, what can one person do when the time to act is now? And now it's up to you. When it's 2019, but it feels like 1933.
Welcome back to part two of the Monday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Yes, it's called Rethink the Week. Yes, we tape it on Friday morning. We're rejoined by Stephen Pimpare, professor of public policy at Vermont Law and Graduate School, Robert Hockett, a professor at Cornell Law, Ryan Melton, who's running in the Iowa's 4th Congressional District, and Lincoln Mitchell, who teaches political science and public policy at Columbia University. Just before we went to the break, you heard from Lincoln Mitchell, and he said, you know, it's really important that we talk about an affirmative agenda going forward after 2024 and remind people that the reason why so much of this agenda is not possible is that there is no significant bipartisan support. Although on occasion, Biden will talk about the bipartisan support, but I'd say 98% of the time it doesn't happen. And as a result, all the things that really make a difference in people's lives that would happen immediately don't happen. I mean, the problem I think with the infrastructure bill and the PP, all those, you know, the CHIPS bill is that, yeah, they're wonderful. You can sort of see the money coming in, but those things will not be completed for 2 years or 4 years or 6 years. So again, if there's a frustration, the frustration is with what's happening to folks now. So Stephen, you mentioned that there were a number of regulations that were coming out of the administration just even in the last week that really will make a difference in people's lives. And you wanted to sort of click through some of them because I think people need to hear them because we're so focused on what's happening in a New York courtroom, what's happening with the Supreme Court, that we fail to realize that really what is happening now that will touch people's lives in real and immediate ways is happening in Washington. So you want to go through that list for us quickly?
Sure. Happy to. I mean, you know, I think this is also an argument in favor of competence, even if the dude is really old, right? That there is something to be said for understanding how to use the levers of the federal bureaucracy in order to do things that improve the well-being of people. So just last week, right, if we're playing on Monday, the Federal Trade Commission made non-compete clauses illegal, right? And these are things, often if you work for a fast food restaurant, in order to get the job, you will have to sign a thing that says that you will not work for another fast food restaurant for 6 months or a year or sometimes even longer when you leave that job. What does that do? It traps people in terrible jobs and makes it impossible not only to leave, but to organize and to fight because the fear of losing the job is too great. You won't get another one. That's going to be illegal depending on what the terrible courts do. Right. The Federal Aviation Administration, right, will now require that airlines tell you when you book a ticket. I know this sounds radical. They will actually have to tell you what the total cost of that ticket is before you click buy, instead of all of these secret charges that pop up over time. Moreover, if you save up for a year in order to take a family vacation and buy those tickets and your flight gets canceled, they will now be obligated to actually refund you the money in precisely the payment method you used to pay it, right? NASA communicated with Voyager, who we thought was dead, 15 billion with a B miles away and fixed it. The Federal Communication Commission reinstated the net neutrality guidelines that were in place under the Obama administration, which among other things means that there's greater opportunity to regulate cable and broadband again on behalf of people who require it in order to live their lives and do their jobs. The Environmental Protection Agency promulgated new rules to restrict the ability of coal plants to dump carcinogens and climate-producing effluents into the air. And finally, and this is not a complete list, there are now new energy standards attached to all construction of affordable housing, right? So what we've got here is an administration that is plugging away and doing the work, whatever complaints you may have with them, and I have plenty in other areas. Nonetheless, this is what competence looks like on behalf of the American people. And as a footnote, does not require immunity from criminal activity.
Again, nobody talks about this, and yet to what somebody said, this should not be told once. This should be told almost every week, 10 times during the course of the week, and then explain to people, this is how it touches your life, and this is how it touches your life. Because just to say the regulation alone, you know that. People are like, oh, what does that mean? Well, this is what it means for you in Nebraska. This is what it means for you in Iowa. And I think we have to do the translation. That's why I want to go to Robert Hockett. So Robert, you posted something on Twitter, or X, or whatever it's called these days, and it was based on the story coming out of California. California has so much solar power that it's throwing it away. And of course, I saw this and I'm like, oh my goodness. And your comment was, again, there is probably no better indication that your productive arrangements are perverse than the presence of a problem that you are compelled to call overproduction. And I was like, well, what happened to things like storage? Like now more than ever, we need to realize that if there's a place to do storage, it would be California. But why do I bring this up? Because there's another piece that came out of the Biden administration, probably even this week. And what they've done is Biden's Solar for All Awards, $7 billion to bring affordable energy to low-income families. The program is designed to reduce greenhouse emissions and energy inequity. And I wanted to sort of bring those two stories together, Robert. One, because I saw that you noticed the story coming out of California. But I think, again, when we hear about, you know, solar panels, or we hear about geothermal, or we hear about conservation, a lot of those poor to middle-class families who can't afford it are like rolling their eyes going, oh, once again, you're benefiting the rich who already can afford these things. But this is so important because not only is it about addressing the climate crisis, but it's about saving those families money. It's not just about a panel. It's not just about conservation. They will suddenly see an electric bill disappear. They will suddenly see a gas bill disappear. That has consequences for them on an everyday basis. So it's both about the climate. It's both about investing in solar, but it means it makes a difference in the economy of their homes.
Yeah. So I think, I mean, two things here, right? I mean, first off, anytime the idea of overproduction is a thing, right? Anytime that it's actually a possible thing, and it's considered to be somehow problematic, then that's a pretty good indicator that your arrangements are all mucked up, right? That something isn't right the way you have things set up. Because ordinarily, right, we think of production and we think of more as a good thing, right? At least if it's good stuff, things that we want, like energy. And so anytime, you know, there's a problem of so-called overproduction, or a time when you have to adopt a program to sort of talk farmers into destroying their crops, as became necessary, of course, during the New Deal period, that's a pretty good indicator, right, that the way that we produce, the arrangements that we have in order to produce, are mucked up, right? And that ideally, and in the longer term, you would fix those arrangements, even if sometimes in the short term, you have to take palliative measures, like paying people to keep their fields fallow or what have you, right? So that's the first point, right? The sort of a macro point, that anytime you see the term overproduction, it's a pretty good indicator that something has to be fundamentally restructured. The second point is precisely, you know, connects up with what you just pointed out in connection with the savings for individuals. A pretty good clue as to how to arrange things better once we have the clue that things are poorly arranged, that is, you know, that is overproduction. A pretty good way to rearrange things or to change structures is to see to it that ordinary folk can benefit through production, right?
Right.
If we're talking about energy, that means enabling people, of course, to solar power their own homes and maybe then to sell any excess or surplus that they have onto the grid, which would be another income source for families, and it would be a way of helping families make ends meet. When it comes to employment, when it comes to the possibility of overproduction thanks to robotics, which will lead to more and more people being rendered redundant from their jobs, the sort of counterpart rearrangement or restructuring that would be necessary, I think, is to change to an economy where people own the firms that they work for, rather than simply being rented by them.
Wow. Again, the idea of ownership and co-ops and those kinds of things, that's kind of an extension beyond the whole idea of organizing as labor, Robert Hockett, it's also saying, well, you don't have to just organize against the boss. You could actually be the boss. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't quite comprehend. But I think that really, in the long run, is about an investment in your long-term financial security. We just lost Robert Hockett, but I'm going to actually turn to you, Ryan Melton, because again, you know, these are issues that have to be front and center for you and Iowa. As you're sort of talking about what's happening with the monopolies, as you're looking at what's going on with the economy of Iowa, there was an article at The Guardian, world billionaires should pay minimum of 2% wealth tax. How is the tax conversation going in Iowa? Is there a sense that not only do you have these, you know, big ag and you have all these monopolies and what you were just describing as the, you know, the Cokes taking over, buying this company that was being created actually to create competition. Do people understand not only is it what they're buying up, but they're not paying or contributing, not even their fair share. They're not contributing any share. And as I'm looking at this, you know, it shouldn't just be the G20 ministers. It should be all of us recognizing that there has to be a consequence to being a billionaire. And part of that consequence is to pay a tax.
Yeah. I mean, one of the more conservative districts in the country, you're going to talk to a number of Republicans, quite a hefty number of Republicans, even if you're a Democrat running for Congress. And the tax issue does come up. And here's the issue. You know, I think, you know, the reddest of Republicans and the bluest Democrats, they'll find common ground on the fact that the wealthiest do not pay their fair share. Like that's not the problem. The problem is that you have a sentiment out here that both of the major parties are captured by corporate power. And so it's not that they don't agree with that. It's that they feel that, especially the Democratic Party out here, there's this perception that the party's corporately captured and that the arguments are disingenuous, that it's optics, but that they're not actually going to carry through that message and actually implement transformative law at the end of the day. And so that's the ultimate issue. Big reason why I reject corporate PAC money. And I've found that, I don't know if you know Steve King, you probably know who Steve King
was. Oh, of course, yes. He was forced out.
Yeah. So Steve King, one of the most conservative, he's arguably, not even arguably, a white nationalist who represented this district for quite a long time. When I say at campaign events where they're mostly progressive Democrats there that I've had a number of Steve King voters vote for me, they are shocked by that. They ask why. And I assure the listeners, I am nothing like Steve King. The issue is that Steve King knew that there's this distrust of institutions. And so he did whatever he could to be anti-institutionalist. And that includes anti-party power. And so he'd say these awful, horrible, terrible things, which even his voters acknowledge they were awful and terrible. But they made him think, well, at least we can trust him because there's no way he can say that stuff and keep gobbling up corporate money. Now, that's not exactly true. And eventually it caught up with him and he got primaried. But people see in me a trust that they don't have for most people. And so you have to, as a politician, if you're going to speak to these issues, you have to be able to culminate enough trust within the people you're talking to for them to even believe you, that you actually really believe what you're saying, instead of just playing optics political games.
Well, I think your point, though, about corporate capture and that both sides are, in fact, part of that corporate capture. I mean, Lincoln, that's true. I mean, when you look, I mean, follow the money. Follow the pharmaceutical money, follow the insurance money, follow the oil and gas money. I mean, you follow the money and the money doesn't go to Republicans. The money goes to both sides. And they go especially to the chairman of many of those committees. And in the Senate, the chairman are Democrats. So I think part of the problem is that it's so easy for Republicans to say, sure, let's talk about taxes. You know, it'll never happen. And all they have to do is point to what they actually want to protect, which is money and politics. So in a lot of ways, how do we break that cycle? How do we do something so that we not only create an opportunity to change the tax structure, but then convince people that they need to trust that that will be the result when they look at, you know, the revolving door and they look at what's happening with the lobbyists and they're following the money and they're saying, how is this even possible? Because the system seems to set those individuals up to fail because they may say one thing, but how is it possible for them to deliver?
I think to fully understand this follow the money question, we have to really try to understand how what the state of campaign funding is in the United States, because there's a lot of different dimensions here. One is, since Citizens United, there are people with enormous wealth, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, billionaires, who can play in politics any way they want.
Exactly.
They can set up independent expenditures. If you are running for president, senator, governor, even mayor of a medium-sized or big city, you need one billionaire in your corner. That's it, right? And those people, while generally far right in their political views, particularly, not surprisingly, on issues of taxation, also have some very quirky and strange views. So, you know, Chris Larson in San Francisco, for example, has completely fetishized police surveillance, right? So he'll fund anybody who wants to put cameras everywhere, but really nice civil libertarian there, right? So there's that piece of it. Then there's the kind of the person, the working person doesn't have a lot of money, but maybe can send $20 to Bernie, but also that person, similar demographic, sending $20 to Donald Trump. So there's the low-level donors. Then there's the kind of the donor class. And this is hugely important. And this includes what I referred to earlier as that top quintile, that top 20%. Again, borrowing from the work of Richard Reeves, because that's where you see so much of this problem, right? So these are not people who necessarily are calling for massive corporate tax cuts or even, you know, getting rid of the estate tax. But they are calling for all of these small things that shift wealth upward and that lead working people who really have very little, few assets to believe the system is rigged, because it is. So when Donald Trump, going back to 2016, says the system is rigged, in a very strange way, he's telling the truth, but he's leaving out the rest of the sentence, which is it's rigged in his favor, right? Right. But let me just go for a couple of examples. You can deduct the interest on the loan on your mortgage, but not on your rent. That is an injustice that shifts wealth upward. Mm-hmm. And if you want to get everybody, Democrat and Republican, nice upper middle class liberals with their Black Lives Matter flags, you know, and many of them strolling around proudly in keffiyehs right now, if you get rid of that, they will flood every Democratic and every Republican congressperson with phone calls telling them this is terrible. The same thing with the 529 college savings program. And I can point to many, many others. So the real issue here is that both parties essentially are captured by one of two things: weird, quirky, right-wing billionaires. And there are a very small number of these on the left, but they're mostly on the right, and they play in the politics of both parties, and a donor class that may differ dramatically on things like reproductive rights. They may also differ dramatically on foreign policy, on even labor policy, but on the specific issues that keep them in that top quintile, they are together, and they will not accept any divergence from that from their elected officials.
So, Stephen, we haven't talked about it, but we can't leave this show without talking about it. And that is that what we're seeing happening on college campuses across the United States. And, you know, initially it seemed to be sort of focused on Columbia, but you can't focus on almost on every college campus, whether you're looking at what's happening in Texas, which you're looking at what's going on in California. But what is so terrifying to me is the article at Slate.com, Cops Called, Why Colleges Are Moving So Quickly to Arrest Student Protesters. And I think what we have to see is, I mean, this is turning into something that is not no longer about a student protest. It is now about a military operation. And I saw a picture, I think it was from Ohio, where you saw like folks in camouflage or outfits with, they were like snipers on top of buildings, but they were called by the college, but they were carrying rifles. That's what they were doing. And I'm like, this is a college campus.
In Ohio, of all states.
Exactly, because of Kent State. Exactly right. And I'm looking at all these stories coming out, and I'm looking at Mike Johnson demanding to call in the National Guard for college protesters. And as I pointed out, Speaker Johnson is now alleging Hamas support for anti-Israel campus protests, and he's threatening not only intervention, but he's talking about defunding these campuses. I'm looking at all this, and it's being so abused and used by the right. And in the end, the understanding of the protest is when you look at who's there, who's involved in the protest. They come from every ethnic group.
We are doing ourselves a real disservice, and this will not age well. The anti-Semitism on these campuses is very real. To pretend it isn't, even if it's been captured by the, and I'm sorry for interrupting, but this is important. It has become an article of faith on the left in the last 2 weeks that to mention anti-Semitism on college campuses is somehow to be complicit in some right-wing plot. This anti-Semitism is real. These people support Hamas, large numbers of them. I have been on Columbia campus since the Monday after this war started. Their demand is not a ceasefire. It is not that simple. We cannot pretend that this anti-Semitism isn't real. And I hear too much of it. And we can't, all of these students 10 years from now, and I have to go and say, why did you sign up with these people? Why did you join these people that celebrated the massacre of Jewish civilians? That's what they've done. They've celebrated it and they've denied it. And that is a reality that doesn't change that these campuses are too militarized. It doesn't change how terribly Governor Abbott, President Shafiq, and these others have mishandled this. But please, please, let's not be complicit in downplaying anti-Semitism because it's an ugly and inconvenient reality.
So, Stephen Pimper, let's talk about it. What do we say? What words do I have permission to use? I mean, I'm trying to figure out, like, so I'm looking at this article that I pulled a paragraph out of. Despite footage showing students of various race, ethnicities, and religions, including Jewish students, participating peacefully in the protests, right-wing politicians and media figures have accused demonstrators of anti-Semitism, of which you are absolutely right, there will be, and call them to be met with a militarized police response. So I'm just going to say, when I look at who was sort of responsible for the ceasefire movement in my state during the presidential primary, it was Andrew Walensky was the lead guy. And he wasn't doing it because he was an anti-Semite. He was doing it because of what he saw happening from a humanitarian perspective in Gaza. So I am just trying to figure out, how do we move forward?
And if Andrew Walensky wore a yarmulke on the campus of Columbia University or a Star of David around his neck, he would feel unsafe. Well, That's the problem. That's the problem.
Because I'm
for a ceasefire too, right? My Jewish students are.
Stephen, I'm just trying to figure out, so how do we have this conversation and how do we move beyond something that right now is shredding almost every college campus in America?
So a couple of things. One is that I can't speak to what's going on specifically on the campus of Columbia University, but I have been trying over the course of the week to make an effort to read the reporting that is going on in student newspapers across the country.
Right, exactly.
And what they communicate paints a very different portrait than Lincoln does, and does in fact suggest that there is a very diverse population of students with very different motivations who are uttering very different kinds of sentiments about very different kinds of things, which is ordinarily what you will find in any kind of large student protest, right? Here's what I think for me is more important, or is as important as we sort of step back and think about the larger consequences of this. One is that the greatest threat to entrenched power is always mass mobilization. And there are a number of observers. I'm thinking of Jamel Bowie. I'm thinking of Miriam Kaba. I'm thinking of Tressie McMillan Cottom, who have observed that this feels like a delayed reaction to the Black Lives Matter movement, which put the fear of God in a whole host of elites who saw the threat of what would happen if we build a cross-racial coalition of people in opposition to state power. So that's observation one. Observation two draws from Erica Chenoweth, who is a scholar of global social movements, who tells us that the thing that causes movements to erupt and spread is not economic conditions, as a lot of people say, it's repression. And one thing that it seems clear, if we try to tell the narrative of this, is that the Columbia University president bears enormous responsibility for the fact that as of last Thursday afternoon, there were 61 protests across U.S. campuses and starting to pop up in other cities in the world. When you send in the police, even if you've got students who are uttering racially threatening or dangerous sentiments, if your response to that as a leader of an education institution is to bring in the police, you are abdicating the notion that universities have the ability to create spaces where we resolve these differences in ways that add light, not heat. And lastly, the thing that scares the crap out of me is that the more we bring in police, the more we increase the chance that a student is going to get killed. And then where are we?
And all of these things can be true at the same time.
Yes, of course.
This can be true.
And I don't disagree.
If you are in a movement and people, a large part of your movement is engaged in the kind of things that if you said out loud in a classroom or a protest at Columbia, you would be expelled or fired by any other group, and you don't do anything about that.
The large part, Lincoln, is what I'm not seeing evidence of in the reporting that I've been seeing.
And on that note, I need to say goodbye to all three of you. I'm sorry we lost Robert Hockett. This is a conversation that we have to continue to have. It is a very difficult conversation, but calling in the police, I agree with you on this one, Stephen Pimpare, that is not the solution. It is a solution for accidental death, because that's exactly what's going to happen, because they're not here for protest. They're here for basically using their weapons, and that's what they're going to do.
Of course. Jewish kids get killed too.
Oh, anyone can get killed. I can get killed.
No, I mean, there's violence on this campus, and some Jewish kids get killed.
I agree. And that's the problem.
It's indiscriminate. By pretending this isn't real. You better.